Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us today. It is Monday, September 25, and a special welcome to our new friends in Bismarck, listening on 89.1. How nice of you to join us. Thanks for tuning in, and if you want an information packet, I always say that. I don't know why I can't say that word, packet. I go into Elmer Fudd. Packwit, if you want, you packwit. Anyway, go to myfaithradio.com and ask for it. We'll send it to you. You get information on us. And thanks for listening. Love to have you part of the listening family. All right, we have really a great second hour coming up this morning. We have Josh McDowell going to come on, and I think he's already on our studio line. He's going to talk about evidence that demands a verdict. It's the completely updated and expanded classic. So we're looking forward to talking to him. He did that with his son, Sean, who is a speaker and a radio guest for programs like Focus on the Family and all kinds of other things. He's assistant professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. So, just like Dad, one smart guy. So we're glad that he is working with Dad and coming up with this. This is going to be great. We're going to talk to him, and then David Aikman's going to be with us. So we have a great second hour. Very upset about what happened in Nashville. There was a gunman that went into that little church in Antioch and opened fire after killing a woman in the parking lot. And he was finally taken down. He is still alive, but he is in jail. And we don't really know what the motive is, but how sad it is that a little church in Nashville is entered by a gunman and they open fire. That's very sad. It's very difficult to process. It's like you can't even safely go to church sometimes on Sunday because of all the violence and craziness in the world. Anyway, we're going to continue our conversation as well on what happened over the weekend in the NFL. And I know it's a conversation that's not easy, and we want to make sure we address all sides of it. And maybe we are talking right now about what we saw, but we don't have a lot of input from a lot of different people. So we're going to invite you, if you can, to tell me what you think. You can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. We're trying to process all this, and we want to be sensitive to all of our listeners. So thanks for being with us. We'll take a short break and be back.
I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. If you and your family are running from one activity to the next, listen to this encouragement from Dr. Linda Mental on how to slow down and get balance back into your life.
If you're just running from activity to activity and you just feel like you're the taxi cab mom or dad who's just constantly on the run and it's too much, then a lot of times I'll say to families, just cut something out. Just decide you're not going to do it. Learn to say no and bring back the family meal. If the schedule is so crazy that people can't even eat one meal together, you really need to rethink that, because the benefits of eating a meal together are absolutely astounding. If you did that, your kids would do better with nutrition, with academic performance. They have a lower risk for delinquent behavior, and that really seems to me like a really small price to pay for some really big results that can make things so much better in your family.
Find more healthy tips for your family from Dr. Linda Mental at myfaithradio.com.
Good morning. It's 9 minutes after the hour, and welcome. So glad you're with us today. Seems like we've had a little bit of a blip getting Josh McDowell on the line, but we're going to keep trying. And if we get him, great. And if not, we'll try to get him rescheduled. He's a busy guy. I remember when I first saw him, I think it was in college. So he was showed up at our college campus. He was talking apologetics. And I thought, I have to go see this guy. I was just a college student. And now I'm getting a chance to maybe talk to him. So maybe I'm just getting too excited. But I think he might still be with us, but he might not. Anyway, we're still talking about what happened over the weekend in the NFL, and I know there's already been some response to the station, so if you're interested in weighing in, we'd love to hear from you. 1-877-933-2484 is the number. 877-933-2484. Tell me what you think. What do you think as a Christian, how should we be looking at this, and what is it doing to your interest in the NFL, and are you clearly understanding what the protest is about, or has it evolved to the point where you don't recognize it anymore? Did it first start as a legitimate protest by Colin Kaepernick, and now it's become something that we don't recognize, which is just the way it works in politics sometimes. Anyway, Rebecca, you had an interesting conversation with me this morning briefly about Revelation 12:12. What a way to start Monday morning.
I know, isn't it? People don't recognize the reference. That's a very battle type. What's the word that David Aikman likes to use? Bellicose.
Bellicose,
yes. It's a very bellicose chapter. See, I do listen. I do listen to when you're talking. And it's about really the war that takes place beyond what we can see. And that was part of the sermon on Sunday. So I have it in my brain right now.
Shall I read Revelation 12:12? Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the seal, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time.
Mm-hmm. And it's more official with the haths. Paths and the vows.
It always makes it way more official.
It is. And really, that whole chapter is fascinating because it describes what's happened kind of from the beginning of the earth to Jesus' ministry, which is kind of summed up in that one verse there when it talks about the child being born and the dragon, which is Satan, tries to devour the child, but it's snatched up away to heaven. Mm-hmm. And he is the one with the iron scepter in his hand. Clearly, that's Jesus reigning. And then there's this loud rejoicing in heaven because the dragon is defeated. The devil is cast out. He has no power and he knows this, but he's cast down to earth. So all of heaven is rejoicing and it's this amazing thing. It's like, look, the devil's defeated. This is awesome, to paraphrase. And then, yeah, but now the devil's on the earth.
Nine.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, problem for us, but not for long.
Not for long. We know how the story ends, which is always the good news. I think we've got Josh with us. Josh, good morning. Maybe not. Josh, good morning. Hey, Josh, good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Am I coming through crystal clear?
Absolutely crystal clear. We're delighted. And thank you for making time out of what I know is a very busy schedule. I remember seeing you when you came to the University of Minnesota. I was a college student, and I thought, I have to go see this guy. I was just thrilled that day seeing you on the college campus. Now I get to speak to you on the air. It's pretty fun.
Well, let me tell you, waking up and starting the day with you guys is like dying and going to heaven.
How nice. Now, you've been able to work with your son, Sean, on this latest updated and expanded classic, Evidence That Demands a Verdict.
I decided it was time to not so much update, but do a total, complete rewrite.
Okay.
It's 70% new.
Oh, wow.
And you know why?
Why?
Truth doesn't change, but its critics do.
Mm. Say
and
more about that.
Questions being asked now, yeah.
Yeah, do say more about that.
Well, the questions being asked now, most of them are significantly different than the questions asked 30, 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have an entire chapter on what is truth. See, 35 years ago, that wasn't a question. Today, it's one of the biggest questions. Can you know truth? Then we have a whole chapter on historical skepticism. Can you understand history? Is there objective truth in history? And then I would say the top chapter, one of the top two chapters, is one called "Is Christianity a Copycat Religion?"
Mm.
Did Christianity come from the Greek mythologies and all the resurrection and everything? And what I prove and document, and I think this will excite people, is actually many of the myths and all came from Christianity. Christianity did not take it from them. And that is a significant historical difference when you can document that.
Wow. Now, when it comes to apologetics, Josh, I would say all of us are called to defend our faith, and we need to constantly be equipping and training and preparing for the next conversation we're going to have as early as today.
Well, if we're going to pass our faith on to the next generation, and you have to understand, we are the first generation that has not passed our faith on to the next generation. And as a result, we're not creating true followers of Jesus Christ. And in today's culture, with the internet and all, if we do not build into our young people, not just what to believe, but why do we believe it, then it doesn't matter what we teach, we will fail. And evidence is a kind of a one-place shopping you can go from beginning to end to prepare yourself to pass your faith on to others and to confidently share your faith with non-believers.
Mm-hmm. Josh, where are we failing in this process of sharing our faith? What seems to be missing?
The why.
The why, okay.
Yeah, for years we could get by with teaching what to believe to our kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever the pastor taught, the parents taught, when a kid walked out of church, walked out of the home, went to school, to various degrees, the structures around that person reinforced what the pastor taught and the parents shared. Now, with the internet, that's totally different.
Mm.
From anything any pastor teaches, their parent shares with their child. The moment that child walks out of that building, almost every single structure flies in their face. And so we can't raise kids with just a good belief system. We've got to do it biblically, where it says, be ready always to give an answer for the hope that is in you. We've got to prepare them to understand the whys of their faith. It's called convictions, or we will fail.
Mm-hmm. Josh, you haven't lost a drop of your passion.
Well, Jesus is still Jesus, and the world is still lost, and families still need help.
Exactly. Josh, do you think that there is a greater amount of rebellion in the culture today than ever before?
I think we're more aware of it than ever before.
Okay.
Because of the internet and the instant cable news and all. But second, there probably is more because now truth has become the victim of modern culture. For most people, there is no truth apart from myself. And this is really affecting culture with conflict. I think you see it with Trump, with things he says, whether good or bad, whether you agree or not. And the way people perceive things and all has changed from 8, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Josh, what do you think? How do you think we're doing at today at loving the lost?
Probably no better than 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I think if there's any organization, any institution that loves people and loves the lost, it is the church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just look at Port Arthur, Houston, Florida, Puerto Rico, I can guarantee you at the front of all the survival aid, everything there were churches.
Mm-hmm.
And Samaritan's Purse, et cetera, et cetera. I'm on crew staff, and just one campus university got all the students together and sent 30-some universities down to Florida to help people. They did that within days.
Mm-hmm.
And that often goes unnoticed. I am proud to be a believer. We make a lot of mistakes, but let me tell you, for the most part, Christians are some of the most loving people. They're also some of the most unloving.
Mm. Josh, are we more afraid of labels today? When I think of being called, you're a racist or a bigot or a hater, I mean, nobody wants to be living in that camp, and it seems like people are quick to assign those kinds of terms to people who come out and say they're a Christian.
You know, I think that's been true for years.
Okay.
There's always a label, which to now is racism, and that's not all bad either. The country, we need to be aware. I'm a white fellow. I need to be so much more aware of what minorities go through. And I can't totally understand it, no matter how hard I try.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you. the thing with Trump right now and the NFL and all,
mm-hmm.
I concluded this last night. To Trump, it has absolutely nothing to do with racism. It has to do with respect for the flag and those who gave their lives for our freedom. To the NFL players, it has everything to do with racism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and neither one seems to be smart enough to understand the other. And it's like two people in the room from two totally different worlds saying we're all talking about the same line. So, I mean, I don't know. But I just want to be so much more sensitive to the racial issue, not just because I'm a Christian. But I try my hardest to understand it, and I still make mistakes with it.
Yeah, and I do too. And I feel the same way you do, Josh, trying to figure out, you know, the whole NFL thing. And I was talking about it earlier this morning, and I've already gotten, you know, feedback from a listener saying that, you know, really what I heard was a one-sided white male point of view. And you don't know what it's like to grow up as a minority. So, you know, it's a difficult situation.
Yeah. So see, to that person, that's a racial issue.
Say more?
To Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And to many of the people who side with Trump, it has absolutely nothing to do with racism. It has to do with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like when the Pittsburgh Steelers all remained in the tunnel during the anthem, except for one man came out, stood there, and put his hand over his heart. He was a veteran. And he did not see it as a racial thing.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying it's not a racial thing. I'm not saying it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But I always said, try to understand your opponent, the person you disagree with. Try to see it through their eyes. Try to see it through their feelings, their history, their emotions. And I got to tell you, when it comes to the racial history of the United States and everything, it's hard for me. But let me tell you, I'm trying my best.
Yeah, I agree. Josh McDowell, you are like the last person I want to put on hold, but I need to do it just for a minute. Let me take a break, and when I come back, more with Josh McDowell in just a minute. Good morning. It's 24 minutes after the hour. I have on our studio line Josh McDowell, author of Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Now, it is completely updated and expanded. And when I say completely updated, I mean it. About 70% of the material is new. So if you've loved this book in the past, you're going to have to get your hands on a copy once again. And he wrote it with his son, Sean. You must be proud of that boy.
I am. he's not only brilliant, and I mean brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And he can not only communicate, but from everything I see as a daddy, he has his life together, his marriage together, and his family together. And that's how I look at people first. What are they like as an individual, as a father, as a husband?
Mm-hmm.
And I like what I see, in fact, with all four of my children. And I'm so grateful and thankful to the Lord for that.
Yeah. Josh, you started off as an atheist, and I always think it's fascinating to hear someone.
No, I started off as an agnostic.
Agnostic, okay. So,
I was smarter than saying I was an atheist.
Okay. So let's say you're an agnostic, and then who got your attention? Who got you to rethink your position? What conversation or who came along and befriended you or got engaged with you?
When I went off to college, I was bitter, hurt, angry, and I saw this small group of students, about 8 students, 2 professors, and lives were different. They seemed to have a genuine love for each other and for people outside their group. And I wanted that, so I made friends with them. I said one day, why are you so different, the other students, the leaders, the professors? And this one young lady just looked back at me and just said, Jesus Christ. And I said, oh, for God's sakes, don't give me that garbage. I'm fed up with religious church. And they turned around and challenged me to intellectually examine the Bible as being the Word of God and true, which I thought was a joke, and Jesus Christ being the Messiah, the Son of God. And they made me so mad. Now, what they were doing was totally appropriate. I was a problem. I said, okay, I'll accept your challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I set out to write evidence against the Christian faith.
Mm.
And when I couldn't, I became a Christian, spent 13 years documenting why. And now in the whole new evidence out, I had to go back and rewrite it because there's been a tsunami of evidence. It's incredible, the evidence that's out there. And there's things in, I think it's chapter 4 in the New Testament, There's no other book it's documented in except for Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And I think that chapter in the New Testament is just going to blow people right out of the water.
Wow.
And it's all documented.
That's awesome.
So that's, I wasn't an atheist. I was agnostic.
Okay.
You don't know, I don't know, so shut up.
Exactly.
That's kind of my attitude was.
Exactly. So when we're trying to engage with honest skeptics, because there's so many people that are just so incredibly hostile to anything gospel-related, and it's very frustrating if you're trying to do apologetics. Or
Christians
if you're...
are the same way with non-Christians, though. We get hostile everything else. Go ahead.
No. I'm just saying, I'm asking, what I want to ask is, how do we best engage in today's culture with skeptics? Let's say they're honest. Let's say they actually are interested in conversation. And then let's talk about ones that aren't.
I found this. Listen to them. Without being judgmental, without stepping in, without interrupting, listen to them. Listen to their story. And respond with creative listening, like saying, well, when did that happen? Well, how did that affect you? What did you feel about that? Without coming in and saying, yeah, but you know the Bible says, but you know Jesus said that. No, just listen. And you know what I've learned over the years? When I listen to somebody else's story, I can't think of a time they wouldn't listen to my story.
Mm.
And it gave me the opportunity to share. And what I believe is share your story and then bring in the evidence, like Evidence That Demands a Verdict. But this new book will give you confidence in sharing your story, and you won't be threatened by listening to someone else's story.
That is such...
Oh, that's good.
That's such wisdom. I heard that, Josh. That is such good wisdom. And, we have heard that time and time again from wise counselors that say we have to start listening to other people's stories. I think we're so quick to show up with a verse, and all of a sudden, we're not listening, are we?
No, we're not.
Yeah.
And I think many people are ignorant about skepticism, atheism, and others because they haven't listened.
Mm-hmm.
You can read all the books you want, but until you sit there and listen on someone, it's just kind of like what we were talking about, the racial situation. I've read about every book out there to try to understand. But it's when I sit down and interact with a black brother, sister, or non-brother, sister, whatever, I learn things and come to understand what it meant in the book. And I think through listening, you become a wise person. Not only knowledgeable, but wise.
That's why I'm letting you do all the talking today.
Well, I was aware of that.
Josh, what are some of your?
I heard that.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite stories from the Evidence That Demands a Verdict? Because this has been out for quite a while.
One was the other day. I was at some conference up in Frisco, Texas, with my son. We're sitting in the green room, and this lady spoke up and said, "My neighbor's daughter got a copy of Evidence That Demands a Verdict and wrote a paper on it for her philosophy class. And in there, she quoted all the way through Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And she got an A in the paper. But when she got the paper back, the woman, she'd circled one after the other saying, this can't be true. How can you know this? There's no proof of this. This can't be true. All the way through the paper. But gave her an A for having the courage to write on it. And a number of months later, this professor came to Christ because of the paper the girl had written from Evidence.
Wow.
Now, I wish more people, but you talk to professors in universities, they'll say there's probably been more papers written and speeches given based on the book Evidence Demands a Verdict than any other book apart from the Bible. Because it's all documented. And people can use it authoritatively.
That's an incredible story. I just love having this conversation with you, and we need to go, but when we get off the line,
I thought we had 2 hours.
Yeah, I know, but when we get off the line, make sure you give Paul, our producer, Sean's email address. I want to get Sean on so we can let him brag about his dad.
Good. And will you tell people that it comes out, the book does, October 3rd in the bookstores.
Okay, I will indeed.
You can go right today to readevidence.com. That's easy enough, readevidence.com, and order it and even get it before it comes out in the bookstores.
You are so good.
Thank you. You're the one that's good. You bring it out of people.
Thanks. I will cherish that little comment. Have a great day, Josh. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, love you.
Love
and
you
next
too.
Time your ratings start to slip, call me.
I will.
Love you, guy.
Thanks Bye-bye. A lot. All right, it's 9:30. We'll take a short break and be back. We've got Dr. David Aikman up next. Good morning. It's 23 minutes until the top of the hour. We've got Dr. David Aikman on our studio line already. He's going to be up next. But embracing God's grace does not mean we have a license to sin. Pastor and author Ray Hollenbach says more about this.
So this is a serious question that's got really deep roots. And that is that if I preach grace, if I lead a small group or a women's Bible study, or if I'm a pastor in the pulpit, if I preach grace, am I telling people that their actions don't matter? But of course our actions matter. And in fact, grace becomes the most effective way for transformation. And you see, that's part of why I wrote the book. I wanted people to see the connection between grace and maturity, between grace and discipleship. I wanted to give people the practical hope that there really is grace for change. If we are a Christian leader in any setting, we have to trust that the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men. And the wisdom of men tends towards legalism. Don't do that. Be sure to do this. And always do this. But it's the foolishness of God in things like the gospel and in preaching and in the message of grace that actually brings the most effective hope for change.
That was Pastor Ray Hollenbach, also an author. If you want to hear that entire interview, head over to myfaithradio.com. Hollenbach is kind of the way it sounds, Hollenbach. Up next, Dr. David Aikman is with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
Now, I'm definitely no fortune teller, but I can always predict when pain will appear in the life of parents. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. After several decades of working with parents and teens, imminent pain has become an easy thing for me to spot. It happens anytime a mom or dad confronts foolish thinking or disagrees with their child's opinion, or when a parent needs to reestablish their authority, expose wrong motives, or limit or restrict their teens. But while these things may be painful, they're absolutely necessary to help teens grow and mature. Mom, Dad, do you avoid discipline because you know it'll be painful? Don't let that keep you from doing your job. The discomfort will soon pass, and someday your efforts will be deeply rewarded.
Learn how to handle the top four fears parents face during the school year. Go to parentingtodaysteens.org.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
Oh, that makes us all smile every time, without fail.
It certainly makes me smile.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And how are you doing?
I'm good. We are always looking forward to our conversations with you because foreign affairs are a little confusing to me and to many others. So when we get your analysis, we always feel much more informed. So thank you for joining us today on the program. I want to start with the German election, which was it yesterday?
Right. It was yesterday, yes. And to Angela Merkel's surprise and disappointment, the new rising nationalist opposition, Alternative for Germany, really did surprisingly well with about 20% in the result. They are now going to have a place in the German parliament, and there's no way that any of the existing German political parties are willing to work with them. But there's no doubt in my mind that this new political stream in Germany is the hallmark of a sort of populist nationalist movement that's really been sweeping Europe for a couple of years now. And Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and then, of course, the Brexit vote. There's no getting away from it. People seem to want to go back to the nation state. And that's exactly what President Trump made the point of in his UN speech, which nobody seems to have noticed in that sense. But it's a very interesting phenomenon in world politics.
So, Dr. Aikman, you're also saying that Germany is trying to do the very same thing, return back to its, expand on that a little bit more, if you would. Ooh, I guess we lost him. There he is.
Back.
Yeah, maybe we've got that iPhone. Maybe we can get that one quieted down.
I'm sorry.
That's yes, okay. That's all right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get your take on...
Yes, Germany, like a lot of countries in Europe, really feels overwhelmed by the sort of centripetal tendencies of being part of the EU. An ever-expanding, increasingly powerful centralized bureaucracy that is not only sort of closing down genuine freedom in the economies of these countries, but is imposing on many of the member countries of the EU a sort of cookie-cutter pattern of compliance with social and cultural and economic requirements that ordinary citizens of these countries simply don't want.
Oh, okay.
And the German vote yesterday has been accused by a lot of the other political parties in Germany of being a sort of Nazi resurgence. I don't think it is. I'm sure there probably are some Nazis in the group, but I think it's a much more centralist resentment against a sort of supranational coercive bureaucracy that ordinary Germans feel is swamping their lives, and this is mm-hmm. a protest vote against that.
Okay. David, talk about the global reaction to the president's UN address, especially when it comes to North Korea.
Well, I think everybody has been sort of my thing is bigger than yours and so on, and basically trivializing a very serious confrontation between two world leaders, one the president and one the leader, unelected, of a rogue country that wants to change all the rules of nuclear weapons and armament and is absolutely sort of bubbling for a fight with the rest of the world, starting with the United States and then going on to South Korea and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not two morally equivalent parties. The United States for years has tried to contain North Korea,
mm-hmm.
sort of imposing various sanctions and various UN-sponsored restrictions on the movements of people and economics in that country, but it's actually seemed to have done no good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And President Trump, rightly or wrongly, has come to the point that he said, we've got to change the equation here. We must stop doing, Einstein's formulation that something that is done twice and you expect success the second time and there's no change,
yeah.
That's a sign of insanity. And so President Trump, I think rightly or wrongly, has said the old system of trying to contain North Korea diplomatically has not worked. The Chinese are only partly on board, so we just have to prepare possibly for the worst scenario, which would be some kind of military conflict. And so we're skating pretty close to the edge of that. And I think if the North Koreans sent up an interceptor to try and stop American bombers from patrolling the international airspace at the edge of their territory, that could lead to some disastrous miscalculation by the North Koreans, which probably would lead to conflict.
Mm-hmm. David, I don't know if I can believe anything the North Koreans say. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience. but I watched them return Otto Warmbier to us, that student, and they said that he had a little case of botulism. Oh, and we gave him a sleeping pill. Oh, now he's in a coma and brain dead.
Yeah, I mean, that was the most grotesque example of how North Korea treats its disliked adversaries. Well, he wasn't an adversary. He was just a college student who wanted to steal a propaganda poster, mm-hmm. just as one might want to take a hotel towel or something. And the poor guy got several months in the labor system, during which he was subjected to who knows what kind of mistreatment that caused him to go into a coma. This is a regime that really does need to change, or this is a country that needs a regime change. Contrary to what Secretary of State Tillerson said, we do not seek regime change. The North Koreans seek regime change like nothing on earth, and we should basically cheer them on and try to offer an alternative.
Mm-hmm. David, let me take a little break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. David Aikman. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. It's 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. David Aikman, our foreign affairs correspondent, all the way from Bray, Ireland. Dr. Aikman, there was a comment that Mr. Trump made at the General Assembly at the UN. He said, the problem with Venezuela is not that socialism has been poorly implemented, but that socialism has been faithfully implemented. Maduro went kind of quiet on that, didn't he?
Yes, I mean, that was an... And you could hear the crackle of laughter throughout the General Assembly chamber.
Uh-huh.
So you knew that many people got the joke, because he issued one of the strongest attacks on the whole principle of socialism that I've heard any American president make since Ronald Reagan. And it's sort of rather unfashionable to attack socialism internationally, but he did it, and he got away with it, and he actually got a quite good reception from it. So that was fairly original. And I'd just like to say the other thing that President Trump made a point of in the General Assembly talk, and this got fairly broad approval of delegates, was that he wanted every country to try to make itself first in the same way that he wanted to make America first. In other words, he wanted nation states to be patriotic, to sort of competitively vie for a strong position in the world, and not succumb to international networks of globalist bureaucracies. And I thought that was a remarkable pronouncement, and didn't really get noticed, I think, either in the U.S. or the foreign press.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the president of Iran's reaction to President Trump's speech at the U.N.?
Well, I think the Iranians have got a sort of knee-jerk response to anything critical of them said by anybody else. And, of course, President Trump was very sharply critical of the whole regime, and starting, as you say, with the whole Otto Warmbier case. But everybody knows who's watched the Iranians that they have continued to try to cobble together this sort of crescent of power throughout the Middle East in countries that are not actually part of Iran. I mean, obviously, they have a big chunk of Syria. They have supported the Hezbollah faction in Lebanon. They have supported the Hamas terrorist network in the Gaza Strip. And the Iranians are on a headlong course to become the sort of major new superpower of the Middle East. So they certainly resent the kind of criticism that Trump gave them in his General Assembly speech.
Mm-hmm. David, the Iranian president said, no one will trust America again if Trump ends the nuclear deal. and thinking, huh, do we trust Iran right now? Do we trust North Korea?
Well, yes. I mean, talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah,
I
no
mean,
kidding.
Who really is going to trust the Iranians on anything given their sort of failures to comply with various United Nations and other international strictures on their nuclear program? So I don't think his complaint about the United States not being trusted anymore after Trump's statements carries any weight. I think it just is a reflection of the whole regime of Iran and their particular stance on expanding their power base.
Mm-hmm. David, we just have about a minute left. Can you make a comment on Myanmar and what's going on there?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, Myanmar is a case where a much revered political opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who sort of was the daughter of somebody who really was prominent in Myanmar's whole independence movement. She'd been kept under house arrest for years by the military regime and had rather heroically resisted this and campaigned for her own personal freedom and for the freedom of politics in Myanmar as a whole. Well, here she is in power with the help of the army, which agreed reluctantly to let her go free and to operate as the leader of Myanmar. And she's caught in a web of complicity in either permitting or if not encouraging the military to crack down fiercely on these Rohingya Muslim minority people who have been forced to flee to Bangladesh. And mm-hmm. it's a tragic situation of a once revered political heroine who has become hoisted by her own petard, as it were.
Mm-hmm. David, I so appreciate you coming on the show. I just appreciate your wisdom and your insight. Have a great week, and I'll speak to you again in a few weeks.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it very much.
Yep.
Bye.
4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and then wrap up the big show. It is a couple minutes until the top of the hour. Thanks for listening today. Did you know that on this day in 1954, Elvis made his first and only appearance at the Grand Ole Opry? The future king of rock and roll sang Blue Moon of Kentucky. The performance was not well received, and the booking agent suggested that Elvis go back to driving a truck. I think we know how that turned out. He was probably a great truck driver, too. And then he turned out to be Elvis, so... Anyway, that wraps up our show today. Thanks so much for listening. We want you to go to myfaithradio.com and you can get podcasts, any of the conversations we had today. Send these on to your friends if you think they would like to hear it, and you can listen as well. Again, have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.